Mein Herz und mein Sinn schwärmt stets nur für wen, wie es weint, wie es lacht.
Heaven, Vienna mine, laughter and music and stars that shine, wonderful city where I belong, to you I sing my song. Placido Domingo sings of Vienna, wonderful city of dreams, laughter, and music. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Vienna has been not only a city of waltzes and wine, but also of military conquest, anti-Semitism, and despair. How have composers of piano music from Schubert to Schoenberg dealt with this city of contradictions? Joining us to discuss and sample her upcoming March 29th concert in Madison called Vienna in Performance is Catherine Kowski, professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're looking forward to a musical excursion through Vienna, the good times and the not so good times.
Right, right.
Well, at what point did Vienna get this reputation as being a musical mecca? I think sometime after Bach, but by the time young Mozart comes along, it's a place to be, isn't it?
That's right. And I suppose it's really Mozart that made it that way. Mozart, of course, was from Salzburg, but was so happy to get away from
the family.
His boss, who he called the Archbooby, the Archduke in Salzburg. And I think probably slightly happy to get away from his family as well, which must have been a pretty domineering place to be. So Mozart certainly made his home in Vienna, and after that, you have the real native son of Vienna, Schubert. And then comes Brahms, and, well, in between Beethoven, of course, who isn't from Vienna, but comes there from Germany and lives there most of his life. And then Brahms, who likewise isn't from there but lives there. So, yeah, I would say it's from the late 1700s on, isn't it, that Vienna seems to just dominate musical life in a sort of fascinating way that must be a mix of just pure luck and a particular cultural climate.
And I know we had you in the past talking about a series on Paris in performance. Now that you've turned to Vienna, how would you contrast those two cities musically?
Well, I suppose one interesting thing is how much longer it took Paris to come to the fore. I mean, there were always wonderful French composers, but I would say that it's really not until the early 20th century that you have a group of them in Paris that you identify really as sort of establishing a kind of French school of music. And that's what Satie and Debussy and to some degree Ravel were so concerned to do, whereas, of course, Vienna had been in the forefront for so much longer, and we talk about the school in the early 20th century as the second Viennese school, that's Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern, as opposed to the first Viennese school, which would have been Mozart and Beethoven and Schubert. So there's a much, much longer tradition, really, in Vienna than there is in Paris. And it's a very, very different one also. There's something in Paris that wants to make music sort of evade or escape from perhaps the more sort of sordid realities of life, whereas certainly the second Viennese school did anything but escape from the sordid realities of life. They wanted to really sort of wallow in them. So anything that's twisted and neurotic and full of despair.
Freudian.
Is of enormous interest to Schoenberg and the Expressionists. Whereas if you think of a composer like Poulenc, we're looking at music that is much more akin almost to nightclub music, to the music of clubs, to the music of circuses, to ways to make music a pleasure that gets you away from the twistings of the psyche.
Almost more extroverted in Paris and introverted in Vienna.
Yeah, I suppose so. Certainly looking inward at the neurotic parts of the mind, I think. But this is of course skipping ahead. This is in the second school. Although I'd say that you can certainly see some hints of it earlier on. And perhaps what we're saying is too simple. It depends which French composers you look at. If you look at Debussy, he's very interested in, and the symbolist poets also very interested in a sort of dream world. So that's also an interior landscape. But I think it's not quite as neurotic an interior landscape. It's one that certainly deals with the subconscious, with layers of the brain that are buried far inside. But it's somehow, it's not about Freud to nearly the same extent.
If we're talking about, let's say, a darker side of Vienna, do we find both of those in somebody like Franz Schubert, whom we think of as a very outgoing composer,
yeah,
you know, writing impromptus and waltzes and improvising party pieces?
Yeah, of course, it's a wonderful question. And I think absolutely we find a very, very dark side in Schubert. And I even think there's a sort of parallel in terms of the historical moment that he lived in to that of Schoenberg. He lived at the turn of the century before, the turn of the 19th rather than the 20th century. And that was a period of enormous trouble in Vienna. That was the period of the Napoleonic conquest of Vienna and then of the extraordinarily repressive regime of Metternich. So it was hardly all waltzes and wine. And yet Vienna seems to have always had this sort of capability for wearing masks. And you see it even very literally in the prominence of masked balls in the actual culture and in the literature. But in Schubert's time, you see it in art as well. The Biedermeier art is all sort of, not all, but so much paintings of contented people in bucolic settings or in sort of family portraits where it's clear that nobody has ever said a crossword. You know, no father or child has ever had any animosity. And yet we know that the society itself was suffering enormously. Vienna was actually a very unhealthy place to live at that point. There was enormous amount of disease, enormous amount of poverty. And particularly when Napoleon was there, a sense of having lost its identity. So this is when Schubert's living. Schubert's own life was hardly a piece of cake.
And what there was of it.
What exactly, there wasn't much of it.
30 years worth.
31. And he was sick for, what, the last 5 years or something, knowing that he would die soon, and never had very much money. So this is, you know, the Schubert who wrote all these waltzes and had Schubertiades every night was nevertheless suffering mightily and was hardly unaware of the difficulties of the times in which he lived. And I think one absolutely hears it in the music. In fact, there's probably no one who makes greater use of the split between major and minor, the possibility of moving back and forth between the major and the minor mode. And I'd thought of actually playing an example, one of the impromptus, which are very ill-named, I'd say, because they sound like such lighthearted, almost sort of dippy little pieces. And in fact, they're quite major compositions, particularly the second set. But there's a wonderful passage in the first one where he moves from this harmony, which is pure major, just an A-flat major chord, to this. Now, if that isn't dark music, what is, right? But it's
beautifully dark. Mm-hmm.
But it's all about the transition. I think if one just started there, it wouldn't have anywhere near the same impact. It's hearing this, and he does it for a long time. So that's Schubert's magic.
So, and that's what you're hearing as the sort of the city of contradictions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There it is in a nutshell, I think. And probably there'd be no more direct way to express it in music than that motion between major and minor.
I want to hear more of that impromptu.
You want to hear more, yes, of that impromptu? Sure. Well, I'll play you the beginning, and then I'm going to skip, because again, there's this juxtaposition that I think is so fascinating between the major and the minor. So it starts in minor. Mm-hmm. Kreisel with this very stormy opening. And then the next really important theme is this. Within that, you hear these constant shifts from major to minor, so that even that original place that I played you, this, then that comes back a little bit later. You know, and so we're always oscillating between that sense of almost a kind of hopelessness and then a shading, a kind of brightening. And Schubert does that. He does that throughout these pieces. Really, the last of the impromptus seems to be almost entirely about moving between major and minor. Its middle section begins. Exactly the same material, but simply presented in the minor mode. So yeah, I don't think that Schubert was all about Schubertiades.
It's tempting to say that he's the most intimate composer up to this point.
I think that there's something about that music that is so somehow personal And you know, I've thought about it because really what he wanted most of all was to write a successful opera.
Big things.
And he wanted to write big, grandiose things, and he could never do it because I think almost he was too honest. You know, that in order to write an opera, everything has to be exaggerated. It has to be bigger than life. It has to project to thousands. And that's not what Schubert did. He talked about one person. Such incredibly personal music.
And writing for the piano in Vienna, I mean, what sort of role did the piano play at that point?
Well, you know, Schubert tried very hard, I think, again, to have a sort of big career. And at one point, he finally scheduled a large-scale concert to publicize his works. And then it turned out that it was on the same night as a concert by Paganini, and no one came. So Schubert's piano, in any case, was really a piano that I think was mostly in the living room. I mean, the big sonatas didn't get published until after his death, and they didn't get performed very much, I think, until about the 1950s. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary that music that great should have lain so dormant for such a long time. So I think for Schubert, the piano was his own instrument. He wrote these pieces to play himself, and he played them at home. And he used the piano, of course, maybe more than anything else, to play with singers.
And sometimes to play with other pianists.
Right, of course. Wonderful forehand music. And in fact, the first concert on my series this year was all forehand music. And obviously, we did some Schubert. We did one kind of cool thing, which was a Schoenberg transcription of Schubert.
Before we leave Schubert, you've mentioned in terms of how he would be sort of Viennese in characteristic that it's that sliding between major and minor, mm-hmm. the intimacy of it. Mm-hmm. What else would you say you hear in those impromptus that makes it Viennese?
Well, I think it's, you know, there you get to the more traditional ideas. There's always a sense of dancing, of Ländler, of waltzes. If you listen to the second one, it's kind of impossible not to think of it as something that people could be moving to. So we do unavoidably identify Vienna with the waltz and with dance. And that's, of course, absolutely part of Schubert. So that and I think the melodic aspect as well, of course, the sense that all of these lines could be sung and that's so intrinsic to what Schubert is doing and somehow to what Vienna represented then too, a city of song and dance.
And we'll look more closely at Vienna, that city of song and dance, in piano music when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Gunnar von Hagen's Body Worlds 1, the original exhibition of real human bodies, now open for a limited engagement at the Milwaukee Public Museum, presented by Northwestern Mutual Foundation. Tickets 414-223-4676.
the sound of Arnold Schoenberg. We're talking to Kathy Kowski about Vienna in Performance. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. We were talking about Schubert and, you know, the more traditional Vienna sound.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have something quite different. What is the link?
Well, what you heard a little bit of is Schoenberg's Opus 19, six little piano pieces, they're called, and they're little indeed. I don't think any one of them is more than 30 seconds long. He wrote them in 1911, so he wrote them before he had come up with the idea of the 12-tone row, which was his attempt to sort of codify a way of writing without tonality. But he certainly was already writing without tonality, just in a much freer way. So this was already music that was an attempt to break away, really in a very revolutionary way, from the music that had been written for the last 250 years. And you can hear in these pieces both remnants of the old music in terms of the kinds of phrasing that Schoenberg uses, the sorts of expressive markings he uses, and things that nobody had ever done before, harmonically particularly.
And why did he come up with this atonal approach in terms of the time and place that he was living
yeah,
in?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there are a number of different answers to it. One of them is simply the answer thought about in terms of music history, which is that tonality had been stretched and stretched and stretched in the 19th century, so that the beginning of the 19th century, you still have people using fairly traditional harmonic progressions. By the middle and certainly the end of the 19th century, composers like Wagner and Richard Strauss are introducing more and more what we call chromatic tones into the scale, so that, you know, if I play a simple 1-4-5-1 progression, we know absolutely what key we're in. But as soon as I start adding notes that aren't, in that simple C major scale, if I start adding, for instance, a triad that's built on F sharp, that doesn't take me back in any direct way to C major. And they started doing this as a sort of coloristic device, but if you add more and more notes that don't belong to the key, you obviously weaken the pull of that home key. And that's what had happened. And if you take that far enough, the home key no longer has any pull, and then why have a home key? So that's, I think, sort of what was happening musically, and that explains why, to some degree, what Schoenberg did was being done in every country. So in France, Debussy is writing music that also often doesn't have a home key. And in the United States, certainly Charles Ives is writing highly dissonant music that usually doesn't have any home key whatsoever, or if it does, it has two of them at the same time. So Schoenberg wasn't the only person who was doing this. What I think distinguished Schoenberg and seems most relevant to the fact that he was from Vienna is his interest in the dissonance and in the ability of this new sort of harmonic approach to convey despair and to convey the sort of contortions of the human mind. I brought in what I think is a good quote from Schoenberg and then from somebody else as well. But what he says is, art belongs to the unconscious. One must express oneself. Express oneself directly, not one's taste or one's upbringing or one's intelligence, knowledge, or skill. Not all these acquired characteristics, but that which is inborn, instinctive. So, you know, I think he's interested in Freud's id. He's certainly not interested in the superego, and even the ego is in the way. He really wants to get down to the bottom of it all. And what's at the bottom of it all can be pretty unpleasant. And you see it, actually, I've been reading a lot of Schnitzler lately, who's a contemporary author writing at the time. And you see these people dealing with sort of basic human urges, which in Romanticism had been glorified and all of a sudden become so depraved in the early part of the 20th century. So that in romantic love, sexual love, of course, was put on a pedestal. And then all of a sudden, in the early, maybe not all of a sudden, but in the early 20th century, romantic love isn't about having one lover. It's about having 20 of them in a row. It's about going from one prostitute to the next. And it's all about a sort of sexual drive. It's about these instinctual drives that are out of conscious control. And I think that that's what it is that distinguishes Schoenberg from certainly from Debussy. And it's what drew him to expressionism in general, so that it's again, not just in music, it's in the art as well. If you look at paintings by someone like Schiele or Kokoschka, who are painting at the same time, the bodies are twisted. They're completely unnatural. One limb is always sort of pulled over another one in a way that you know would be so painful. And that's what I think they're interested in conveying.
I blame it all on Copernicus, Darwin, and Freud. Man is no longer the center, and man is no longer next to the angels.
Yeah, and just man another animal. Is not in control of himself, I think. And the idea, I think, had been that music would, before this, would put things in control, would impose an order, right? That's what art was there to do. And so a composer like Mozart or Beethoven imposes structure on whatever those, you know, those violent urges might be. But Schoenberg wants their wildness to be heard.
All right, question, practical question here, yeah. Comparing, say, Schubert and Schoenberg. How were people using this music of Schoenberg's compared to what they had done with Schubert? I mean, you know, I don't think you're going to get together at a party and let's play a few Schoenberg things together and kind of celebrate our beastliness.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think around this time there is a sort of change sociologically in the role of the composer in society. And among all the many different ways that Schoenberg was alienated, I think he was extremely alienated from Viennese society. And that's actually probably partly what made him who he was and why he had to be in Vienna. This whole idea of all these people going to, you know, all these glittering balls could not have felt more removed from who he was. And so he said, the hell with the public. You know? And in fact, I heard one quote where he said he was thrilled to go off and fight in World War I because it was so much better than staying home in Vienna.
So, that's, you know, quite an endorsement.
If you imagine the battlefront in World War I being superior to his home hearth, then you realize things were pretty bad. So he made his living by teaching, I think. And he wrote a big harmony textbook. He had an actual sort of school for teaching composition. He was not making his living from people wanting to play his compositions.
And was it all serious for Schoenberg? I mean, I was thinking about how when we talked to you about Debussy, there was this spirit of play.
Yes.
But it seems pretty serious, pretty dark.
You know, except I've been thinking about that also, because I think it's so fascinating how the French were so into music halls and the circus and, you know, children's books, etc. And I don't see that with Schoenberg. And yet, there is a strain, right? First of all, here we have Schoenberg transcribing Johann Strauss waltzes, right? And he also wrote a wonderful group of cabaret songs. So he's not all serious.
Played tennis with Gershwin.
They were good friends. That right?
Yeah.
He played tennis with Gershwin?
Yes. Oh, yes. Out in, you know, Hollywood. And it's two personalities you would never connect. And he knew, you know, people. Korngold, for example, who was noted mostly as a film composer at that time.
So there must have been another side. But at this period, particularly in Vienna, you know, his own life was pretty tragic. His wife was having an affair. He was hated by the Viennese public. Then there are suicides gone wild in this society. It's another thing that fascinates me about it. But the one in his life is that apparently his wife was having an affair with a painter who then, when she broke up with him and came back to Schoenberg, the painter committed suicide and did so by first burning all his paintings and then hanging himself naked in front of a mirror. So you see these sort of despairing gestures brought to the level of theater.
Well, I have a Schoenberg confession. I've played Schoenberg in orchestras and so on, and yeah. I try to like it. Cerebrally, I can appreciate it, the atonal, just the complexity of it. But I can't love it the way I can when you play the Schubert.
Right.
And it almost seems, if you're listening to what you just played, the Schoenberg piano music, it almost makes you feel suicidal a little bit. It's so alienated sounding.
You know, I actually think these pieces are not all that alienated. I think some of the other music is very alienated. And I think, you know, I guess he would say tough luck.
But I'm asking, I mean, do you love it the way you do Schubert? And if you do, what is it that draws you in?
I don't love it the way I do Schubert. I don't react the same way that I do to Schubert at all. But I think it's very, very beautifully crafted music. And I do react to it. I find the lines, the sort of twisting of the lines. Actually, let me play you a little bit of one that is very easy to listen to, I think, and maybe conveys what I do like. This is the second one of Opus 19. It starts like this. It's all about thirds. Everything in it is a third. So it starts with these little thirds. And then it has. So that line, that yeah, I do find that very compelling. I guess because it Kandinsky talked about jumping spots in his paintings, and I think it's the jumping spot. It's that huge gap that you really couldn't sing, that goes sort of beyond human limits in that sense. And then we're back to that sort of absolutely unbudging third. And then again a line. So I find the lines very beautiful. I found that in the Schoenberg songs that I've played as well. Same thing in the violin fantasy. I do find that they sort of get inside and twist at me. Not the same way Schubert does. There's the other quote I really like is actually from Charles Ives. He says, "Beauty in music..." And this is not meant to accuse you. It says, "Beauty in music is too often confused with something that lets the ears lie back in an easy chair." Now, I guess I like that easy chair too, and I don't think that Schubert is really in an easy chair. But nevertheless, we hear what they're saying, right? They're saying that beauty doesn't have to be pretty.
Right, because life isn't pretty, and I understand exactly. That in modern literature, sometimes there's a reason to have things not rhyme and be all resolved. But sometimes when I'm trying to listen to Schoenberg or to Berg or to Webern, I'm looking for a hook or even, I mean, you can't go home singing the tune. You can't,
no.
It doesn't become part of you the same
right.
way. And so sometimes
I think that's right. I think it's much, much harder. And in fact, I think almost one of the principles of Schoenberg is to avoid repetition, whereas one of the principles of someone like Schubert was that you always had tunes coming back. It's so much harder for us because we want something familiar. And yet my guess is that it is like the, in a sense, like stream of consciousness writers also, that what he's interested in is conveying the way the mind works, right? And our thoughts we don't go back and have exactly the same thought. Our mind is constantly sort of moving along. So, yes, I think he's trying to convey something differently.
And what difference did Viennese politics make to Schoenberg?
Well, you know, Schoenberg, of course, got caught in the Nazis. That's a little later than the period that I'm dealing with. But Schoenberg was Jewish. He converted, and then he converted back. I think the role of Jews in early 20th century Vienna is an interesting one. They really, for the most part, weren't particularly interested in asserting their Judaism. And in fact, many, many, many of them converted because they really didn't care. They wanted to be assimilated. And it was the Nazis who said, no, you can't be. It wasn't the Jews, really, who insisted on their own identity. Ironically, it was the Nazis who insisted on their own identity. So Schoenberg was caught in that. He actually was quite patriotic about World War I. He was very much in favor of what the Austrians and Germans were doing then. And in fact, there's an interesting quote about how now they're going to sort of defeat all that frilly French music, and that's going to be wiped off the face of the earth. It's not very appealing, those sentiments. But it's quite remarkable how many very prominent intellectuals and artists were swept off their feet by the idea of an Austrian-German victory in World War I. So at that point, despite his alienation from the musical society in Vienna, Schoenberg obviously felt very, very patriotic. Later on, he had to emigrate, and you mentioned his playing tennis with Gershwin in L.A. So he made it over and lived in California for quite a while and taught there as well.
Well, speaking of the French, which Kathy was just a moment ago, we'll find out how a French composer ties in with performance in Vienna in the early years of the 20th century. We'll also look at another prominent composer of the time, Alban Berg. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air.
Listening options are available at WPR.org, the Ideas Network, the NPR News and Classical Music Network, WPR's new HD2 Classical Music, and more. Listen to what you want to hear at WPR.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Catherine Kautsky. We're talking about performance, piano composers in Vienna, early 19th century and now the early 20th century. And Schoenberg, I suppose, is the best known of those second wave of Viennese piano composers. But how influential was he among other composers to follow?
Well, he was enormously influential, and he really spent a lot of his time teaching, both in Vienna and when he came to the United States. But in Vienna, his two most famous pupils were Berg and Webern, but they were by no means his only pupils. And I'm going to, in fact, play a piece on this program by another pupil who's been becoming more and more well-known recently. His name is Victor Ullmann, and this piece is a set of variations and a very complex double fugue on the fourth of the Schoenberg Opus 19, which we were looking at the first two of those pieces before. Ullmann has come to prominence lately with the increased attention that's been given to particularly the concentration camp Theresienstadt and more generally the composers who were put to death by the Nazis in a time of their relative youth. So Ullmann is one of these. He was from Czechoslovakia, but came to Vienna in high school, went to high school in Vienna, served briefly in World War I, then came back and actually went to law school in Vienna, but at the same time went and studied with Schoenberg. And then moved, I believe, to Prague, where he took up studies with Zemlinsky, who had been Schoenberg's teacher. So they're kind of interesting lineages here. And he was quite successful. And then when the Nazis came to power, he eventually got rounded up and taken to Theresienstadt, which was this concentration camp. I've actually been there. It's open now as a sort of, we wouldn't call it a tourist site. In any case, it's not far from Prague, and it's a camp that was used by the Germans as a sort of model camp. They opened it up to the Red Cross to come and see, for the Red Cross to come and see how well they were treating their prisoners. And it's really an astonishing place to visit because so many artists were there, visual artists, theatrical artists, and musicians. And they all continued their crafts while they were there. So that the place now is full of displays of artwork and of, you know, texts and props from theater productions that were put on. There were orchestras formed. These people were there for years. In fact, Ullman himself wasn't shipped off until 44, the year before the war ended, when he was shipped off to a death camp. So in any case, his music has been getting more and more prominence recently as people have been looking at the sort of lost generation of Jewish composers. And I looked at the piece because I was interested, of course, to see what someone had done with Schoenberg. I'll play a bit of this number 4 from the Schoenberg. So that's all of, what, 20 seconds long? And Ullman takes it and makes of it a very complex composition. He actually wrote 2 versions, one with, I believe, what is it, 11 variations or something like that, and another with 5. I'm doing the one with 5, which ends then with a big double fugue, all using this theme. And the variations before it are kind of interesting. A couple of them are actually little dance forms, which sort of takes us back to this Viennese idea of how important traditional dances continued to be in Vienna, even after people were writing this highly complex, dissonant, intellectual music. So one of them, you remember the theme starts, and one of them is a tempo of a gavotte, and the next one is a minuet. Just full of charm. Then the double fugue, I would say, is not exactly charming, but it's fascinating. So the theme again, you start out, and here's the fugue subject. So there are those pitches, just right on. Then he introduces a second subject, which is taken from parts of the piece. Etc. And then he combines the two, like this. So you have on top. On the bottom, you have, again, together, they're this. So it's actually pretty cool.
It seems really clever. I'm also impressed because when I saw that you were doing on your program 5 variations on a theme by Schoenberg, I had trouble imagining a theme in Schoenberg that would be distinct enough to then hear that variation, but you really can.
You
in that
really
piece.
Hear the variations. And what I think is so fascinating is that he finds these really playful aspects of that theme, which are really not that apparent when you first hear the theme. So it's as if he really sort of digs down into the subconscious of the theme and finds all these different aspects of it. So I've enjoyed doing it a lot, and it's kind of cool because it's written almost exactly a century after the Schubert impromptus. So this program covers a period from 1827, which was the year before Schubert's death, when he wrote the impromptus, to something like 1927. It's actually appears that he wrote these between 1925 and 1929, Ullman. So we have that 100 years, and it's kind of interesting to see the things that are retained and the things that have been completely annihilated in that century of Austrian music.
How does Alban Berg stand out on his own?
Well, Alban Berg, of course, is one of Schoenberg's most famous students, and possibly he's the one that is, I don't know if one would say, the most likable. That seems like a poor choice of adjectives. But he's the one that maybe we find the easiest to relate to, because while he did adopt Schoenberg's atonal language, he retained a lot more of the German Romanticism that had preceded it than Schoenberg was willing to retain. So in his music, there's certainly an enormous amount of dissonance, and yet there is always a melody line. And I think there's not nearly so much of that feeling of those jumping spots that characterize the Schoenberg that you hear, that sense of constant octave displacement where you're moving constantly to extremes of registers, which, as you say, make it impossible to go home and whistle the tune. Mm-hmm. But in Berg, there are tunes. They might not be very easy for most of us to whistle, but there certainly are recognizable melodies, and there's also recognizable repetition. And there's a sense of very direct communication of human angst, I think.
Well, you've included in your program for March 29th his Sonata Opus 1. Can you give us just a little sample
Sure.
of that from 1907 to 8?
I'll play you a little bit of it. And I should say that it's really the only thing that Berg wrote for the piano, so that it's not that I've chosen it from among his piano works. It chose itself. So I'll play a bit and talk about it a bit. It starts out. That's a good place to stop, because that's the opening coming back again. And it sort of illustrates the idea that you do have recognizable themes. In fact, there are a large number of themes in this exposition. It's a traditional sonata form. And they're all related to each other. And so you always feel like there's something familiar, I think, that you're hearing. You start out with this sort of very sense of really reaching for this high tritone. And then where I stopped, you heard. And along the way, Berg writes directions to the pianist on almost every note, as if the music is so fraught with emotion that traditional notation won't contain it. And he has to constantly notate accelerandos and retards and accents, stringendo. I'm just reading accelerando, retard, a tempo, accelerando, a crescendo, stringendo, molto retard, retarde diminuendo. That's just the first two lines. So that's about 8 measures with all of those instructions. So he's trying so hard to tell the pianist how to carry this very, very heavy load of emotion, of expressionism.
I think that's called interpretation angst. Are they going to get it? Are they going to get it?
Exactly.
Now, you're ending your March 29th program with a sort of French interloper. Explain
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did so much French music last year. I think I was having separation anxiety. But also, Ravel wrote actually two pieces which are really an homage to the Viennese. One is La Valse, which you could hear with orchestra or with two pianos, and there is actually a one piano version, but I didn't undertake that. But what I did undertake is his piece called Valse Noble Sentimentale, Noble and Sentimental Waltzes. And he actually prefaces it with quite a lovely quote. I'm translating roughly from the French. He has a dot 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 and then it says, "The delicious pleasure always knew of a useless occupation." So that's got to be a reference to the waltz, right? And these are a set of eight very beautiful waltzes. I can play you, this is maybe the most simple sort of waltz theme. Followed you. Etc. So there's something sort of tender about these Viennese waltzes clothed in French harmonies, really. And also something I think very regretful. The last one of them is a kind of reminiscence where he brings back just little fragments from the previous ones. It ends like this, with the second one that I played you. Remember that's from number two. And at the very end then of the whole set, it's as if you can just sort of see this whole world fading away. That sort of traditional Vienna, the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, all of those beautiful balls. It was over, you know, and they knew it was over. This is written in 1911, and it had a few more years to go, but they weren't healthy years. So I think Ravel and everybody else knew that this was kind of the last time that you could write noble and sentimental waltzes. So that's where I'm ending my program.
That's where we're ending this one, too. Catherine Kowski, thank you for joining us at the piano and enlightening us about Vienna for the piano. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.